Welcome to Oncology Today, the management of ER-positive metastatic breast cancer, a program focused on optimal selection and sequencing of available and emerging therapies. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Erica Hamilton from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, Tennessee. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a video component with Dr. Hamilton's slide presentation. To begin, I asked Dr. Hamilton to comment on her approach to choosing first-line therapy in metastatic ER-positive breast cancer. Basically, what I want to do to begin here is to focus on selection of therapy, first-line therapy in metastatic disease. And I'd like you to kind of go through that in several different clinical scenarios. And let's just start with a postmenopausal patient just to keep it sort of straightforward. And I'd like you to kind of talk a little bit about, first of all, the kind of workup you would do in the patient, including genomic workup. And generally speaking, outside a clinical trial setting, how you would approach therapy. And let me tell you the situations I'd like you to go through. I'd like you to start out with de novo. Then I'd like you to talk about somebody who relapses on an adjuvant AI. Then I'd like you to talk about somebody who relapses after having stopped an adjuvant AI, let's say at 5 or 10 years. So can you kind of go through how you think through, first of all, the workup for patients in those three situations and also treatment?
Sure. Universally, regardless of the three situations, when somebody's diagnosed with newly metastatic disease, I'm going to be biopsying that patient. Even if they've recently had breast cancer and had their breast biopsy, certainly distant disease can look different than the primary. It can have estrogen loss. The patient can be more triple negative. I've had liver mets that have been HER2 positive. So I'm going to try to get tissue there. Certainly send it for ER, PR, and HER2. That would be an opportunity that we could profile. I tend to profile my patients if I have tissue in the first line setting and I have enough of it, although I don't have a strong preference of whether that occurs first line or after the first line treatment. Really, most of the information that we're going to be using to make decisions there would happen after CDK4/6. Regardless, in all three of those situations, I'm going to be thinking about a CDK4/6 inhibitor. I do think that our benefit from CDK4/6 inhibitor really is quite dramatic in progression-free survival. And so unless I have a good reason to not offer that to a patient, I'm universally offering it. So for the de novo patient, I would be thinking about aromatase inhibitor in combination with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. In my practice, I tend to use palbociclib, although I don't think that it's superior or have a great reason to. I think it's just the habit that we've gotten in. So I would probably put that patient on letrozole with palbociclib. For the second patient in your scenario that relapsed while on an aromatase inhibitor, I wouldn't be very confident with another aromatase inhibitor as the backbone there. So that's a patient that I would combine my CDK4/6 inhibitor with fulvestrant. And then for the third patient that had been on aromatase inhibitor, completed their therapy, been disease-free for a while, I would again go back to a letrozole with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. So CDK4/6 inhibitor across the board and a little bit difference in the backbone depending on recent aromatase inhibitor use.
So we'll carry on those scenarios, the second line setting in a little bit. I want to also bring up the issue of chemotherapy. Are there any situations where you might choose to integrate chemotherapy as first line therapy?
There is the very, very rare situation that I would give somebody chemotherapy up front. And that's true visceral crisis. That is LFTs that are very elevated. The thought, if I don't have a response in 8 weeks, I'm afraid this patient isn't going to make it type of scenario. But we've done trials with a capecitabine versus endocrine therapy with CDK4/6 inhibitor, and capecitabine did not beat CDK4/6. So with those drugs having an overall survival benefit and with chemotherapy not beating them really in terms of progression-free survival or any type of response criteria, I'm universally using the CDK4/6 inhibitors up front. The other theoretical, and I don't have a whole lot of information to back this claim up, but I also prefer to not use chemotherapy until I have to. I think that sometimes when we treat patients with chemotherapy, we change the biology of the disease a little bit. And so I'm afraid that those patients may be less likely to go on to respond to endocrine therapies in the future.
So I want to go back to what you were saying about the workup. So how would you respond to the statement that all patients who are diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer should have some type of somatic testing, such as NGS and germline panel testing?
Absolutely.
Agree or disagree?
I agree. I think the debatable part is where in their treatment course that needs to happen. So again, for an ER-positive patient, I wouldn't be thinking about a PARP inhibitor first line. PARP inhibitors improve progression-free survival. They don't improve overall survival yet. So I'm going to universally use the CDK4/6 inhibitor before the PARP inhibitor. But yes, everyone should have BRCA testing. We have a great therapeutic options there. And everyone should have an NGS at some point, whether to be looking for the PI3 kinase inhibitors. I think as they're more heavily pretreated, that it also becomes very important to look for ESR1 mutations and other alterations that we may be able to target.
So I guess we had a case recently that really attracted my attention. Very astute general medical oncologist presented a patient. I think he actually did NGS up front and saw she had an ESR1 mutation up front, but still treated her with an AI. She did not respond, switched to the fulvestrant. She did respond. I couldn't believe it. It sounded like it was out of a textbook.
Yeah.
And so I think the investigator reviewing the case said, you, quote, only see this 3% of the time or something up front. But meanwhile, we do a lot of testing for stuff that's even less common than 3% of a common tumor. Do you think you should get ESR1 testing up front?
Yeah, you bring up a perfect point. So that's true, everything, even the 3-4%. So we've seen some data over the past year, the PADA-1 study, for example, that was presented, I believe, maybe at ESMO Breast, and also at ASCO, there was a follow-up, I think. But essentially, ESR1s are rare up front, but they do occur about 3-4% of the time. The interesting thing about the PADA-1 trial is it wasn't the primary purpose of the trial, but they captured those patients that had ESR1 mutations up front, and everybody received an AI and a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Well, interestingly enough, they were following ESR1 mutations over time, and 2/3 of the patients cleared their ESR1 mutation while on an AI and CDK4/6. So it sounds like that particular oncologist patient fell in that 1/3 bucket that didn't do well. But it's very interesting because CDK4/6 inhibitors are changing a lot of rules for us, right? We traditionally thought that if you have an ESR1 mutation, you're not going to respond to an AI. We've thought fulvestrant is better than aromatase inhibitors. But in the presence of a CDK4/6 inhibitor, those rules don't necessarily apply. So I think I would follow that patient very carefully. But the fact that they have an ESR1 mutation doesn't uniformly mean that they wouldn't respond to AI and CDK4/6.
That is really cool. I did not know that. Really interesting. Also, getting back to these three scenarios we were talking about and your thought that CDK is really standard first line, one thing you kind of hear about sometimes is the very older patient with a non-visceral disease, 85, 90-year-old, node-only disease, maybe low-grade bone disease. Any situations there where you could justify not using CDK?
Yeah, the situations that I haven't used it are patients that the count checks are problematic. They may be in a nursing facility. They have difficulty with transportation or getting to the clinic, or I'm really just looking to give them something where they're not having to come in every 2 weeks for a month and monthly thereafter, that, you know, maybe they could come in every 3 months or, you know, every 4 months with scans or something like that. Those are the situations that I don't. I think it's certainly worth a conversation in somebody that's quite elderly. It's tricky, the age criteria. You know, there are 70-year-olds that are older than 90-year-olds and 90-year-olds that you think are going to live at least 5 years, right? And so really, if I think that they're going to live beyond 2 or 3 years where that progression-free survival or overall survival matters, I'm probably at least talking about the CDK4/6 inhibitor with them and seeing what their preferences are.
Let's talk a little bit about choice of CDK inhibitor and also the toxicity profiles, which I think really does have a lot to do with choice, since I guess you think everybody pretty much accepts from an efficacy point of view these drugs are interchangeable?
I do. I think in the metastatic setting, it's very hard to make an argument that they're not equal. I think what's put a little bit of a wrench in it is the recent adjuvant CDK4/6 data with abemaciclib in the MONARCH-E trial having the positive data and palbociclib being negative, whether we're talking about Pallas or Penelope B. And hopefully we see the results of the NATALEE trial with ribociclib soon. But I still think in the metastatic setting, they perform equal. I mean, we've had huge trials with thousands of women, and the hazard ratios, I mean, they're identical. They're 0.55 across all of the trials. We've learned, to kind of change the subject just a little bit, that immunotherapy and triple negative, metastatic disease behaves differently than early disease does. And there's rationale that maybe that's the case for hormone receptor positive too. So just because perhaps maybe one looks like it works in the adjuvant setting, I wouldn't extrapolate that to say that they're different in the metastatic setting when we don't have any evidence to say they are.
So yesterday I was talking with an investigator about myeloma. We were talking about anti-CD38 antibodies. You have daratumumab, isatuximab, and everybody says they're the same. You have this situation with CDK. There are a bunch of situations, checkpoint inhibitors, really, when you think about it in solid tumors in general, it's really hard to separate them out. You know, people really believe that they kind of work the same. So when you have that kind of situation, as I think you described for metastatic disease, I don't get too far out on that. But in your gut, what do you think is explaining the difference in the adjuvant setting? Do you think it's a sort of biology, pharmacology, or maybe the way the trials are done?
I've waffled in my opinions on that. I think the easier answer is to say that the trials were designed differently, and they were. Monarch E contained much higher risk patients, over 20% more N2s, so less kind of N1s or lower risk disease. They also had a much lower discontinuation rate than Pallas did. Pallas's discontinuation rate for CDK4/6 before the 2 years was 42%. So, I mean, almost half. And so I think that that is potentially an explanation. The other explanation is, well, gosh, the Monarch E patients were so high risk that maybe you're actually just treating subclinical metastatic disease and you're not curing people, and that we're going to see these curves come back together like we saw in Penelope. And I think only some follow-up will answer that question for us. And then the other, maybe a little bit more scary answer is, you know, some of the neoadjuvant data with CDK4/6 inhibitors, it shows a beautiful drop in Ki-67 on therapy, but then the CDK4/6 inhibitors are always stopped 2 weeks before surgery. And by the time you take the patient to surgery, the Ki-67 is back where it was already. And so theoretically, could the fact that abemaciclib is continuous and it doesn't have that week off intermittent, somehow could that be playing a role biologically where those cells aren't completely dying? They're kind of alive and just kind of going through cycles of sleeping? Maybe. I don't know that we have the answer on that yet.
So it's really interesting to speculate on. So getting back to more of the pragmatics of choosing, I guess one sort of global thing, you know, people always say just exactly what you said. I'm used to using Palbo, so that's usually what I start with. So I guess my first question would be, putting that issue aside, which certainly is important clinically, what your clinical experience is, but in terms of the data that we have, how would you compare the tolerability profile of ribo and efficacy for that matter and palbo? I mean, is it, because a lot of people would choose palbo just because...
I think they're very, very similar. I think that palbo and ribo are incredibly similar. The only other thing about ribociclib is that you have to look at the LFTs and you have to do the EKGs. Now, in my oncology clinic, we do clinical trials. So we have cabinets full of EKG machines. But in some oncology practices, getting EKGs is having a cardiologist see that patient. And so I think that's a differentiating factor for some. But other than that, I think from a tolerability standpoint, palbo and ribo are very similar, and same from an efficacy standpoint.
So when you consider, let's say, palbo/ribo versus abema, what are some of the things that you think about, and how do you prepare a patient who's about to get palbo and ribo versus how you prepare a patient about to get abema?
Yeah, so I kind of discuss that with the patients. I explain that palbociclib and ribociclib are more likely to have neutropenia and more likely to probably need to be dose reduced for neutropenia, less GI effects. And conversely, I explained that abemaciclib is less likely to give us count issues and dose reductions for that, but more likely to cause diarrhea. And so there are some subtle things in somebody's history that will kind of lead me in one direction or another, right? If we have a woman in her 30s or 40s that sits in the carpool lane at school, diarrhea is not a great choice there, right? And so that's a patient that I'm going to be thinking more about palbociclib or ribociclib. If I have an older patient that has a lower neutrophil count at baseline, or some African-American patients run a lower neutrophil count at baseline, and I know that's going to be a sticking point, I'm more likely to pick abemaciclib. Or similarly, somebody that has a lot of cancer-associated pain and is on narcotics and may struggle with constipation, well, that's a perfect side effect for them. So abemaciclib may actually be helpful because then they're not going to have so much problems with constipation.
You mentioned African-American patients. What's your understanding of sort of the pathophysiology of the neutropenia you see there? And what do we know about those people when they receive, for example, palbo or ribo or any CDK inhibitor?
Yeah. You know, it's funny, you know, our lab normal values are a range, right? And it's a range that encompasses a 90-ish percent of people, and some people fall out of it. It's a quite normal variant. Those patients that have lower neutrophil counts, they're not predisposed to infection. They do quite well. In my experience, my African-American patients, the majority of them don't have lower counts. They do just fine. I've had a couple that have. And again, one I mentioned to you earlier that I actually had to move from palbociclib over to abemaciclib. But she did fine on abemaciclib.
But is there an understanding of why you see lower counts? And is it some kind of unknown genetic mechanism, or what is it?
Yeah, I don't know the exact rationale behind it. It's just a normal genetic variant.
Another question, and I don't know whether maybe some of your patients, some more astute patients, might bring this up, and I don't know if there's any data on it, which is the relationship between the neutropenia and potential susceptibility to COVID.
Yeah. It's a great question and something we've been dealing with a lot. It's tough. We don't precisely have the answer to that. We know that patients that are on chemotherapy tend to have more complications than, say, patients that are on endocrine therapy or not on chemotherapy. CDK4/6 inhibitors are kind of that gray zone, right? We have a decreased count like chemotherapy, but it's not chemotherapy. It doesn't translate to febrile neutropenia or infections like chemotherapy. And so whether that truly translates to any higher complication rate with COVID, it's a little bit tough. We know that metastatic cancer in general can impair immune functioning. And so those patients are at a little bit higher risk. Luckily, I've not had anyone get into trouble with severe COVID that's been on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I'll knock on wood because I don't want that to happen in the next couple of months.
So another common question that comes up is, that in one of your cases, that kind of started to get into this a little bit, was the patient who's triple positive, ER positive and HER2 positive. The initial data that came out really didn't include those patients. Subsequently, we saw some data. What do we know about it from the clinical trial point of view? And practically speaking, do you ever use CDK in your HER2 positive patients?
Yeah, I haven't used CDK4/6 very frequently in HER2 positive patients. We're looking at that more than we used to, right? I think you're absolutely right. We kind of had the blinders on that HER2 patients were HER2, and we kind of forgot or ignored and pushed the paper under the fact that they're ER positive and PR positive too. Certainly, we have quite a benefit with pertuzumab in the first line. T-DM1 gives us a benefit. But you know, the regimens combining fulvestrant with a CDK or an AI with CDK and trastuzumab, it's very attractive for these patients. The majority of patients with HER2 positive disease will get antibody drug conjugates or chemotherapy sometimes for years. And so especially, I think, earlier on when their disease may be a little bit more responsive to therapy, I think it's a great thing to pursue.
So let's move on to the more complicated question of second line therapy. In these three scenarios, again, can you sort of go through, you talked about what your first line therapy is. Can you talk about how you think through and work the patient up in the second line situation?
Yeah. So second line is where I'm definitely going to be making sure I have profiling for that patient. That's the point at which I would re-biopsy if they've been on for a very long time. I mean, if somebody has been on a therapy for 3 years and suddenly progresses with new liver lesions, I'm of course wanting to know if they're PI3 kinase mutated, but I'm also wanting to make sure that this is still ER/PR positive disease. If it's been a shorter amount of time, blood-based test may work to kind of get our answer for PI3. But if a patient is PI3 kinase mutant in their tumor, then I would be thinking about fulvestrant with alpelisib in scenario 1 and 3, the patients that were on letrozole with CDK4/6 up front. And for the patient that was on fulvestrant with CDK4/6, I would be thinking about switching to an AI then with the alpelisib for the recent data. for patients that do not have a PI3 kinase mutation, I think that's a little bit of the hairier situation. I'll tell you that I'm a huge SERD fan, and so I would be seeking out trials for anybody that I could get on trial. In the absence of trial, I think if there's no ESR1 mutation, exemestane everolimus could be a great option. If there was an ESR1 mutation, I probably would not favor that. I'd be thinking about fulvestrant there. So that's probably what I would do.
Maybe, I'm curious, everybody talks about if they have a PIK3 mutation to give them alpelisib, but what evidence do we have, either direct or indirect, that that's better than, for example, everolimus plus hormones?
Yeah, so you're saying instead of giving alpelisib for PI3, why don't we just do exemestane everolimus? Yeah, I mean, we don't have direct data there. Certainly no comparisons. It's a great point. You know, I mean, I think the PI3, we have a marker that predicts who responds there. For the everolimus, we haven't ever been able to have a great marker, right? It's not patients with mutations or amplifications. It's kind of all comers. So to me, if I have a PI3 kinase mutation, I'm probably going to pick alpelisib because it's directly tied there together. In the absence of that, that's probably what I'm thinking about everolimus, because that's a patient that's not going to respond to alpelisib.
I've got to say, and I don't know, of course, I'm kind of watching this from the outside, but I always kind of thought everolimus kind of got the short end of the stick. I mean, it had like a hazard rate of 0.2 or something, and everybody was all upset about the mucositis and everything.
Did.
And I'm like, this drug seems like it really works. Yeah. Then alpelisib comes along, which, you know, has its own issues. So am I wrong? Is everolimus, in your clinical experience, does it work?
No, you're not wrong. And I think it's this classic thing where we aren't as good at managing the side effects of a drug. And so we get this perception that we don't like it, and then we get better at managing it, but in our head, we still just don't like it. Right. And so, I mean, I think the Swish study to prevent stomatitis with the steroid mouthwash helped tolerability a lot. We've learned more about dose reductions for everolimus. That's helped a lot. But you're absolutely right on the hazard ratios. I think we all thought, okay, well, here's a great win, but dual mTORs are going to be better and PI3 is going to be better. And none of it has really panned out that it's been better than everolimus. So it is an underutilized drug, likely.
I mean, sometimes people, whenever you combine stuff, you know, it gets tricky to figure out. I guess it wasn't like, I guess I think a little bit about an HCC when atezolizumab Bev came along. It was just so clearly, they didn't even need to compare it to anything. They could see that it was just so clearly better. And I don't know that I get that feeling exactly with alpelisib, but maybe clinically you do. For example, do you think you can pick up for the benefit, the extra benefit that you get with alpelisib? For that matter, can you pick up the benefit of everolimus in these situations clinically? Do you see it? Do you feel like it really is helping the patient?
Yeah, I mean, there are some patients that do well on exemestane everolimus for a long time, and I wouldn't anticipate them to do that well on exemestane. So I'm imagining that's the combination of everolimus. Alpelisib is a tough drug, and I practice in Tennessee. And so we have a lot of patients that are a little bit heavier, a lot of patients that are pre-diabetic or diabetic. And so I personally have a tough time with alpelisib in my population. It's not just kind of mild elevation in blood glucose that 500 of metformin will take care of. I mean, a lot of these patients end up on multiple drug regimens from endocrinology. And those drugs, you know, metformin causes diarrhea. I mean, some of these caused yeast infections, fatigue. It really adds to the cumulative burden of how patients are doing and their quality of life. So it can be tough.
But again, you know, and again, I'm reflecting back to this myeloma chat I had yesterday with Joseph McHale. And when I talk to general medical oncologists, which I'm doing a lot of nowadays, you know, they talk about they just can't give the drug. And then talk to him and he goes, well, you have to start this first and you have to do this and then it's no problem. So a lot of times, and I've heard a lot of general oncologists pose the question to investigators like you who have a lot more experience with alpelisib, for example, any pearls you have about sort of getting patients, preparing a patient to go through alpelisib and getting them through it? What do your nurses do? And when you do all that, how do patients do?
In my personal experience, I think alpelisib is tough, even for me, even in my clinic. I think the reason that a lot of times it's tougher for general oncologists is that we get familiar with its use on clinical trial, which is much more frequent visits, which is much closer monitoring, which is a nurse calling them at home very frequently to see how they're doing. And that's not necessarily happening once the drug is approved, right? They're not coming into the clinic every week to check their labs anyway. And so those are opportunities to intervene on the rash, intervene on the diarrhea, et cetera, earlier. And I think it's much more common for people to get into more trouble at home. So pearls. Pearls is I would make sure that every patient has loperamide at home and carry it in their purse, right? Once diarrhea gets bad, it's very hard to stop it. But if you can kind of pop one loperamide after the first episode of diarrhea, patients do much better. The other is the antihistamines, drug like Claritin or Zyrtec or something over the counter can help some with the rash. And that's a drug that doesn't have a whole lot of side effects, nor is it expensive for patients. And so I would start that to kind of help prophylax against rash. And then, you know, I just am very cautious with patients that are heavier or have quite not normal baseline blood glucose.
So what about the patient with the prior type 2 diabetes? Do you start this? Do you use alpelisib in those patients or diabetes patients with pre-existing diabetes?
I tend not to, no.
But one thing I was thinking about, though, and this came up when we were talking about selinexor yesterday, is I think one of the, you know, a lot of our follow-up procedures have been developed based on people coming in to the clinic. And of course, now in this year, we've learned a lot about telemedicine. And I wonder if we need to rethink, would it be better to do a 10-minute phone call with a nurse like every week or twice a week than have them come in once every 3 weeks? That what you need is really more input.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, things that are second nature to us. How many times I have patients that come in despite talking about how to use loperamide, they said, well, I took two and it didn't get better. And I said, well, when you had another episode of diarrhea, did you take another? Well, no. I mean, you know, it's just not second nature to patients. So, I mean, I think telemedicine, nurse phone checks are incredibly helpful because we can intervene before things get severe.
So I want to talk a little bit about where things might be heading in terms of ER positive disease and the use of endocrine-related strategies. I guess one of the things that's most exciting, at least to me, because I remember when fulvestrant came out, I thought it was going to really dominate. It was just so cool. And it kind of like sort of has been there the last, I don't know, like 30 years or something. What about these oral SERDs? Can you talk a little bit about how they work, sort of the pharmacology of them, and whether you think this is going to really be a major step forward?
I do think it's going to be a major step forward, and it would not surprise me if we see SERDs used in the adjuvant setting and they replace aromatase inhibitors, to be quite honest. Already studies are going in with CDK4/6 inhibitors, trying to go up against CDK in various settings, substituting out backbones. So SERDs are selective estrogen receptor degraders, right? So instead of blocking estrogen, getting to the estrogen receptor, it's binding the estrogen receptor and chewing it up and spitting it out, getting rid of that receptor. So it's going to work in a normal wild type estrogen receptor, and it's also going to work in an ESR1 mutant estrogen receptor where there's constant signaling there regardless of estrogen. It's funny that you mentioned fulvestrant. Fulvestrant's a great drug in a lot of ways. One of the things that hurt us is that we got the dose wrong on fulvestrant initially. It was approved at 250, and it wasn't until years later that we really went back and said, gosh, 500 was the right dose. And had we not run out of patent life on that, in the trials, fulvestrant beat AI. So we probably would be using fulvestrant up front and not aromatase inhibitors if we kind of hadn't run out of patent life to do those large trials to put it there. So that's an important point. As far as the oral SERDs, I think they're even better than fulvestrant. I know they are, in fact. Most of our patients have already seen fulvestrant on the oral SERDs in clinical trials. In fact, the vast majority of patients have seen fulvestrant. And patients are still responding. I mean, we're getting some partial responses, but a lot of patients that are getting benefit for 6 months or longer. And so I'm very excited about this class of compounds. It's also a huge win for patients that they're not having to get shots in the hip. Fulvestrant can make you sore, right? It's not comfortable and people don't like shots. So to be able to go back to taking a pill at home is a lot easier as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And of course, this year we've been very sensitive to kind of trying to keep people out of the clinic whenever possible. So that's another advantage. One of the things that's always fascinated me about endocrine therapy has been the trials looking at neoadjuvant therapy. And I'm kind of curious, it's so hard when you have metastatic disease to really get precise about the biology and just things like looking at Calkey-67 response, et cetera. Have the oral SERDs been looked at in that situation?
Yeah, they have been some. CDK4/6 inhibitors have also been looked at quite a bit there. But it's interesting, AIs, and I've used some in the neoadjuvant setting, right? Elderly woman that's not quite fit for surgery, has a bigger tumor, right? So the problem is you really need to be on an AI for a while to make any difference, probably 6 months or so. When we add CDK4/6 inhibitors, we've seen actual responses in the neoadjuvant setting in ER-positive disease. So I think that's a potential spot that is more helpful. And definitely SERDs. SERDs have been looked at there, although it's interesting, most of the SERDs that have been looked at neoadjuvant have really been more for dose finding. I think there's a lot of concern about getting the dose right and not making the mistake with fulvestrant, because SERDs are a class of medicines that you're not going to hit a traditional MTD. You're not going to be limited by rash. You're not going to be limited by nausea. And so to make sure that we're not giving too much of a drug that people don't need, but also making sure that we're giving enough. And so kind of looking at several dose levels and looking at ER expression, Ki-67, and making sure that we're getting that dose that's biologically right, not just the highest dose people can tolerate.
What about combinations? I don't know if it really sort of theoretically makes any sense to combine anything with a SERD. I know there were AI plus fulvestrant studies that I guess were sort of promising in some situations.
Yeah, I mean, we can combine anything with a SERD that we can combine with an AI. So you can imagine SERD everolimus studies. You can imagine SERD even alpelisib, certainly SERD CDK4/6. And I think that that's probably the most prominent thing that's going on right now is SERD CDK4/6 in a post AI CDK4/6 setting as a substitute to AI CDK4/6, and then even in the adjuvant setting as an improvement on AI CDK4/6.
What are some of the other new strategies that are being looked at in ER-positive disease? And one I was really curious about is the AKT inhibitors. Can you explain sort of what they do and what we know about them at this point?
Yeah, so AKT inhibitors, the ones that we've been more familiar with in breast cancer are capivasertib and ipatasertib. And so they're pan-AKT inhibitors. They inhibit AKT1, 2, and 3. And this is in the PI3 kinase mTOR AKT axis that we talk about all the time, whether it's everolimus or whether it's alpelisib. What's been unique about the AKT inhibitors is, unlike alpelisib, patients do not need to have a mutation in that pathway to derive benefit. So the benefit has been in all comers regardless of alterations in the pathway. And so I think that's really advantageous because, you know, we're really kind of subsetting breast cancer of what mutation do you have, quite frequently, but it's nice to have drugs that kind of work for everybody regardless. Interestingly, they've had a recent loss in triple negative disease. There's been a loss in combination with paclitaxel for hormone receptor positive disease, but I still remain pretty optimistic in combination with fulvestrant. We've seen phase 2 trial data that actually improved overall survival. And so the phase 3 is actively enrolling and we anticipate seeing results of that. So I'm optimistic there.
And what's the design of the phase 3?
It's fulvestrant with or without the AKT inhibitor.
So if that trial is positive, like, where's it going to fit in?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's going to fit in. I think you're going to have to choose in a PI3 patient whether you would want to use alpelisib or whether we'd use the AKT. But I think it's going to pick up that vast majority of patients that don't qualify for PI3, whether they're not PI3 mutant or whether they have a comorbidity such as diabetes where PI3 isn't a smart choice.
And I guess, again, we'll be sort of stuck with indirectly comparing it to everolimus.
Absolutely. We never have as high a quality data as we would strive to have, right?
So another question I have is, I know you see a lot of second opinions or patients coming in for trial, people who've been managed by docs in practice. I'm curious if there are any things you see when you review people's cases, you see people not doing that they maybe should do or things that they shouldn't be doing. And yeah. One thing I wonder about is we still see chemotherapy. I was asking you about chemo. Do you see chemo being used in patients that you wouldn't use it in, and any other sort of any other things you see being done in practice commonly that you wouldn't do?
That's such a great question. Fascinating one. Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest thing I see that kind of makes me cringe are the ER positive patients getting chemo too early. I think when somebody's diagnosed with metastatic disease and you see cancer in the liver, I mean, it's kind of this gut reaction that you just want to fix it. And so a lot of times that's pull out the chemo card. But for hormone receptor positive breast cancer, that has not proved to be better than CDK4/6. CDK4/6 has an overall survival advantage. It's been compared to chemotherapy such as capecitabine in randomized trials and did not beat it. And patients prefer to be on endocrine therapy CDK4/6. So unless somebody truly has a visceral crisis, I'm not giving chemotherapy there. And I think that extends to kind of a second layer of maybe mistakes, is that when somebody progresses on an AI and CDK4/6 and they did well on that drug for a while, I wouldn't throw out the endocrine therapies at that point and move to chemotherapy. I would try a fulvestrant. I would try an exemestane everolimus to really kind of exhaust our endocrine options before we move on to chemotherapy.
Speaking of chemotherapy, I'm curious how you typically sequence chemo in the ER positive, HER2 negative. The typical patient who's older, doesn't have visceral disease, what's usually your first line chemo and second line chemo?
My first line chemo, regardless of whether it's a 30-year-old or a 90-year-old, would be capecitabine. Capecitabine works really well for ER positive disease. It's also advantageous that you won't lose your hair. It's not IV. And so kind of switching to chemo, having to sit in an IV infusion can be very shocking for patients. So I find it's a good gateway drug to chemo, and it also works really well.
How about second line?
Second line, I'm more variable on. I think a drug that's extremely active in breast cancer is eribulin. So I tend to use eribulin pretty much as early as I can. It has this approval for two prior chemo lines. Depending on whether patients got adjuvant chemo, a lot of times I'm successful in getting that approved, kind of all looped together once they had adjuvant chemo and CAPE. It used to be a little bit tougher, but it hasn't been recently. I use gemcitabine frequently. I think that's a drug that people tolerate pretty well. Biggest side effects are low platelets, but you know, patients feel pretty well on that. So that's another drug I use with some frequency.
It's interesting that you bring up eribulin, because I thought there was some data saying it worked better in triple negative. Of course, it doesn't mean it doesn't work in ER positive, but so your clinical experience has been positive with eribulin and ER positive.
Yeah, and recall that eribulin will give you higher response rates in triple negative than ER positive disease, but not necessarily longer progression-free survival. So our ER positive patients just don't have their cancer shrink. It's a slower growing tumor, and so it's not going to melt away and give you PRs necessarily, but it still works very well to control disease for some time.
So, you know, we have our own way of doing consensus and guidelines. We just ask 25 people what they do, and if they all say the same thing, well, we call that a consensus. And I was just thinking about your statement that you just made, and I've heard other people make the same statement supporting capecitabine as first-line therapy. So as you said that, I was immediately flashing on, okay, if we ask 25 investigators what they would say, I'll predict more than half of them will agree with you. And if you ask 100 general medical oncologists, I'm not so sure about that. What we were talking before about seeing patients come in. Do you see capecitabine as the first chemo or not necessarily?
A lot of times I do. I think the advantages to the other side is somebody that has a lot of nausea and doesn't want pills, somebody that you're worried about compliance in, and so you just want to put them in the chair and know that they got the right dose and you don't have to worry about it and they're good for 3 weeks. I think that that's another one. But yeah, I do see capecitabine being given quite a while in the community, you know, quite frequently up front. I don't know whether that's because hopefully our community kind of gets educated very well on clinical trials and recent results, but I do see that given a lot. Another thing maybe to bring up is the recent data of the oral taxanes that came out of San Antonio. And, you know, one of them was combined with capecitabine, and it showed an improvement in progression-free survival, although it was only a couple of months.
Right.
And to my look, there was really a lot more toxicity, a lot more neuropathy, a lot more nausea. So in my standpoint there, I would prefer to be thinking about an oral taxane as a standalone single agent than in combination. We've really moved away from using combination chemotherapy in hormone receptor positive disease in the metastatic setting. It doesn't seem like it gives you a whole lot more other than toxicity. But I think that the oral taxanes we are going to see more and more about. But I think we have to be very thoughtful about, you know, are we just trying to get 2 months of progression-free survival, or what is the cost of doing that? Cost from a side effect profile and also financial.
I don't know if you've used any of these oral taxanes, but what do we know right now about their tolerability compared to IV?
Yeah, I have. There's the one that kind of is a standalone, and that was combined capecitabine with the tesotaxel. And then there's another one that's given with this other pill that's a PGP pump, which kind of it inhibits the drug transport through the PGP pump. That trial was given alone. So I'm a little bit more excited about that. I don't think it's a better drug than tesotaxel. I just like the trial design a little bit better that it was given as a single agent. I did participate on the capecitabine tesotaxel study. I do think it was more toxic, more frequent dose reductions, more issues with neutropenia. I had more issues with hand-foot that was almost a combination between capecitabine and tesotaxel. So you get the traditional hand-foot from cape, but then fingernails falling off, which is more of a taxane side effect. But to the point that, I mean, the hands were kind of cracking and bleeding and were really kind of difficult to take care of.
So one final question, going back to our original scenarios of first-line therapy and second-line therapy, we can just pick, let's just pick de novo. Curious what your algorithm would be like in the patient who's a known BRCA germline carrier.
Oh, great question. Okay, so de novo patient, I would give upfront AI with a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And then it depends. If they had a PI3 kinase mutation, I'd probably consider the fulvestrant with alpelisib. I would very likely consider the PARP inhibitor early. I would certainly give the PARP inhibitor before I gave any chemotherapy. So that's kind of my line in the sand. I would consider other endocrine options, maybe ahead of it, but I would give the PARP inhibitor before I gave any chemo.
So really final question, any, you want to put your money down on the Olympia adjuvant trial?
Yes, I think that it is going to show a benefit. There was a very small neoadjuvant trial of PARP inhibitor for patients that had BRCA alterations. And again, it was given neoadjuvant. And we did ultrasounds or mammograms every 2 months. And so you did it 2 months and you could either take the patient off then and send him to surgery. You could keep them on to 4, you repeated it, you keep them on to 6. So it was up to 6 months, and then everybody went to surgery. Now, to make sure that we weren't compromising anybody's outcome, you could get whatever adjuvant chemo you wanted to get. So if they wanted to have AC to T, if they wanted to get TC, that wasn't affected. It was essentially just adding extra neoadjuvant PARP inhibitor. And the response rate was very large, like 70%. So I think that PARP inhibitor for those patients with BRCA alterations are very powerful.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Hamilton, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.